Thank you for listening to the Shanghai Community Fellowship Podcast. To find out more about the SCF community, listen to sermons, and upcoming events, visit us at shanghaifellowship.org.
Well, today, of course, is Easter, right? You know that. And you can imagine why Christians get pretty excited about this particular day. It's because the resurrection of Jesus, all of Christianity holds together on this one day. I mean, there's a lot that we can talk about, what Christianity is, what it means, the full range and scope of Christian faith. But when it comes right down to it, it is all held together on this one day. By this one day, the resurrection of Jesus Christ. If there's no resurrection, then it's just an empty religious movement of kind people doing kind things for other kind people. You know, I mean, it just doesn't hold together. It has to have a resurrection. There has to be Jesus. And so on this day, now some 2,000 or so years later, we are celebrating his resurrection and thankful, very, very thankful for it. You know, if for no other reason that we could probably get agreement in this room, if not really all over the world, no matter what language we speak or what culture we come from or even what religion we are, that there is evil in our world. We live with it. We see it. We see the evidence of it even today. I don't think we'd get an argument that there's evil. There's evil in the world. And I don't think we'd get much of an argument with the idea that our world and our lives would be much better if there was no evil. It'd be better. It would be a good place. The world would be a pretty good place if there was no evil in the world. It was completely removed. And the thing is, God feels exactly the same way. It's just that the same evil that we see all over the world, and we see the bad people that we label as the bad people, and we see other people doing evil things and declare that they are evil. Well, that same element of evil is in every single one of us. It's in every one of us. And you may not be someone who's going to go up and blow up a building or crash a plane or anything like that, but that same evil that we see in the worst of us is really present in all of us. And so God knows that too. And he's got a plan. And the plan was to get it out, to get that evil out of every single one of us. He, like you and me, doesn't want to see any evil in the world. And he'd love to see that all gone. But to get it out of me and you, well, God knows that actually the surgery would kill us. The operation of getting the evil removed out of us would actually kill every one of us. It would be true, there wouldn't be any more evil, I guess, but we wouldn't be here either. How to get the evil out of every single one of us and yet save the life of the patient? How would we do that? And so God had a plan, and that was to send one perfect human who was both fully God and fully human, who didn't have any evil in him at all, although he was a human being like you and me, but without any of that evil inside of him. If life was going to be the cost of getting the evil removed out of me and out of the world, then if that one who was perfect without any evil in him would give his life, and because of who he was, both God and man, that he would be empowered, his perfect life, traded for my evil, sinful life, gives me the consequence. The life and the consequences of his life are now my life, and the consequences of his life are now the consequences of my life, which are good and right. And that was the plan. One would come. One person, one fully human being person, fully God and fully man, would take my death, would die instead of me dying, and in his death would remove the evil from the world. Here's the thing. The way it happens is that I have to believe that this is actually the plan, and that it is happening through Jesus Christ, who is that one person. Now, if we had just, as was prayed earlier when Khan prayed for us, as we heard earlier, if it was just about crucifixion, then we could look on Jesus' story as a very heartwarming and inspiring story. Someone giving their life for another person. Who doesn't like a story like that? A movie plot that has a beautiful person sacrificing their life for another beautiful person, or even the lowly or the downcast? That's a very moving story. But that's all it would have been. We need the resurrection so that what Jesus has done isn't just about him doing a good thing, but Jesus empowering every single one of us who believes on him with the goodness of his life, now the goodness of my life, and the evil of my life removed from me in Jesus' name. That's what resurrection is all about. Paul would say it this way: if there is no resurrection, then we are still dead in our sins. And the cool thing about the resurrection, and why we're so excited about it and really grateful, is that because he was raised on the third day, because there's an empty tomb, because Jesus is alive today, it means that some 2,000 years later, almost 2,000 years later, in 1971, an 11-year-old boy in Cleveland, Ohio, could kneel beside his bed at night and pray, "Jesus, would you forgive me? Would you come into my life and completely take over? I confess my sin to you, and I will follow you." And now all the evil and the sinfulness of that little boy, just 11 years old, is completely removed. It's changed. He's changed because Jesus is alive. And that's why we're so excited. Because even today, Jesus is still present, still bringing us out of our sin, still delivering us from evil, still caring for us, still giving us life. And this story is being has been captured for us in something called Gospels. And these are parts of the Bible. And there are four Gospels. One's written by Matthew, one's written by John, one's written by Luke. And one of those Gospels, which tell us of the life and work of Jesus, is written by someone named Mark, who was actually a very close friend of the apostle and one of the original disciples named Peter. And today, we're going to look at what Mark has to say about what happened with Jesus on the morning that they discovered he had been risen from the dead. Okay, so you know Friday. Friday's the day that Jesus was crucified. He dies on the cross. He's removed from the cross. His body is removed. He's laid in a tomb on Friday afternoon, all day Saturday. That's day two. And on day three, Sunday morning, they go to the tomb. And here's where we pick up the story, Mark 16. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome bought spices so that they might go and anoint Jesus' body. Very early on the first day of the week, just after sunrise, they were on their way to the tomb, and they asked each other, "Who will roll the stone away from the entrance of the tomb?" So up until this point, everything looks very, very normal. Now, when someone dies in those days and they're buried in a tomb, which is like a cave that's been carved out on the side of a hill, it was a two-room type cave, and so the body, by this point, it's already the third day. It's probably decomposing quite badly. And these three women, Mary from Magdala, Mary the mother of James, and Salome, they are going to do what has been done for hundreds and hundreds of years before them. It's a process of caring for the decomposing body of a friend or a loved one after death. And so they have purchased the appropriate spices. They are walking on their way to the tomb. It's something to note that it's not Jesus' family members who are doing this. Normally, it would be family members, but it's not. Today, there are three of his closest friends, and they're coming to care for what they believe is the lifeless body in this tomb. Now, as they walk along and they're talking, I'm sure together, they're probably planning it out in their head, well, we're going to do this, and one of us will take this care of this, and I brought this spice. And it's part of the softness and the appeal of the storyteller, who is Mark, to capture this detail. That while they were walking along, one of them asked, "Hey, who's going to roll the stone away?" Because the stone is a very, very large, round, and heavy stone. And rolling it usually down a track downhill is usually fairly easy. And one person could just kind of push it and manage it. But once it rolls slightly downhill, it rests in a cradle so that it rests covering the opening of the tomb. To remove the stone from in front of the tomb is going to take a serious effort. It's going to take three or four men pushing with all their strength to rock it out of the cradle that it's sitting in and pushing it back up the hill. And it's capturing the very soft warmth of the moment, if you will, while these three women are walking together. It's just then as they're walking, having left home, that one of them says, "Hey, yeah, you know, how are we going to push that stone back?" It'd be like you and your friends leaving somewhere for maybe worship team practice at SCF, and one of you says, "Did you bring the key?" I don't know. I didn't bring the key. Did you? I thought you had the key. I don't know. I didn't have a key. I thought she was going to bring the key. But you've already left. You're halfway to the worship practice room, and you realize, what are we going to do with it? We don't have a key. So they're having this conversation. How will we roll the stone away? Their anticipation is very clear and obvious when we read. But when they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had been rolled away. And as they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. So they're having this conversation. Who's going to remove the stone? They're probably, back and forth talking, walking and talking. And if they lived in Shanghai, they would be walking and looking at their phone. But instead, this was pre-phone. So they're walking and talking to each other, say, who's going to remove the stone? They look up, and the stone has been rolled away. Now, for you and I, many of us here in this room, you already knew that the stone was rolled away before you even read this story. In fact, when you got up this morning, you already knew that the stone had been rolled away. If I had asked you yesterday, do you know that the stone has been rolled away that's covering the tomb of Jesus? You would say, oh yeah, I know that. I know this story. I've heard it 100 times. You already knew that. But for these women, Mary from Magdala, Mary, the mother of James, and Salome, they did not know that stone was going to be rolled away. They fully anticipated a covered tomb, and now they walk and they see with surprise and shock. I'm just trying to help us to capture the shock and surprise of that day. It reminded me, as I was thinking about this part of the story, something that happened to my family several years ago. And we were staying with a family member in the U.S., and we had left for the afternoon. And when we came back, we pulled our car up, in front of the flat where we were staying, and we parked outside, and we're talking to each other, and we're gathering our bags out of the car like you do, just having a conference, laughing about the shopping and the fun that we had this afternoon. When one of us looks over and we see that the front door of the flat has been broken through. The door is wide open, and the door itself is just hanging on one of the hinges. We said, "Well, what happened?" When we left, the door was closed. I know it was closed. I closed it myself. I locked it. Now, if you've ever had that happen to you, you've walked up to your home, you go up your elevator to the seventh floor, you live in 7B, and the elevator opens and you see an open door. You're like, whoa, what happened? The door to my flat is open. I think I locked it. I thought I locked it. Automatically, the laughter stops, the giggling stops, the conversation stops, everything stops. You are completely focused in on that open door. Right? And that's the way it was for them. I believe that as they saw that open door, that open tomb, they're like, what has happened here? And not only that, still reeling, I'm sure, from the shock and the surprise. I can't believe what's going on. And then an angelic visitor, an angel, begins to speak to them. You're already reeling, just trying to figure out what happened. Why is the tomb open? And now an angelic visitor begins to speak to you. This doesn't happen to you every day. Angels from God don't just like show up and start having conversations with you. And you're just, what is happening? You've got an angel speaking to you, greeting you. And there in that empty tomb, all you know is that this tomb is empty, the body of Jesus should be in this tomb, but it is empty, but you don't know why it's empty. You don't know what has happened to the body of Jesus. You need some kind of an explanation. And I'd like to suggest that just as it was then, it is still today, there is still an empty tomb, but God still needs a messenger to explain, why is the tomb empty? What happened here? What's going on? God still needs someone to explain, why is this tomb empty and what happened to Jesus? And they heard him out and they heard him explain it. He said, don't be alarmed. You are looking for Jesus the Nazarene who was crucified, and he has risen. He is not here. He see the place where they laid him. But go tell his disciples and Peter, he is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him just as he told you. Trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. All right, so I want to point out to help us to see that this angel, he's got these three women, and shocked, surprised, not expecting an angel now talking to them. This is a supernatural experience, and the angel is helping them in this way. He tells them, you are looking for Jesus the Nazarene. What's he doing? He is identifying specifically who it is that they're looking for. In other words, you've come to the right tomb. You didn't take a left turn when you should have taken a right turn. You didn't go to Jacob's cemetery when you should have come to Arimathea's Joseph's cemetery. You didn't go to the wrong tomb. You didn't go to the wrong cemetery. You didn't go to the wrong graveyard. You are right where you're supposed to be. Yes, indeed, there's an angelic messenger confirming to you, you didn't get lost. This indeed is Jesus's tomb, Jesus of Nazareth, the same Jesus who was crucified just recently. So there's no mistake about whose tomb you are at. For them and for us, this is the empty tomb of Jesus. And he says, he is risen. He is risen. He's not here. Go and tell his disciples and Peter, he is going ahead of you to meet you in Galilee. Now, you know, you got to give these three women maybe a little bit of a break, maybe just a little bit of understanding. You've gotten up that morning. You are still devastated at the death of your friend. You have prepared spices. You've got a very difficult and emotional task this morning. It's going to take you all morning, if not two-thirds of the day. It will be hard. It's emotionally hard. You just see that the tombstone has been rolled away, and now you've got an angel speaking to you. Maybe we shouldn't be too hard on them. When an angel says to them, here's my instruction to you, go and tell Peter and the other disciples, and what they do is run away and don't tell anybody. I mean, an angel. What would you do? If an angel said to me, maybe I'd run away too. I was like, an angel just spoke to me, I am out of here. You know, I'm running the opposite direction, and I'm not going to say anything to anybody. Boy, if I told the guys at work, if I told the people in my dorm what just happened to me, I don't know what they would think. I'm not going to say anything to anybody about what just happened here. And they run away and they don't say anything. And what I want to suggest to you today is this, that while this morning, or this afternoon rather, where we, and I'm sure morning someplace all over the world, people are celebrating with joy and singing and dancing and great joy over the fact that Jesus is risen. And there's nothing wrong with that. On the very first morning, however, on that very first Easter morning, they weren't singing and dancing and going, woohoo, wow, whoa, this is awesome. They were afraid. They were running in terror. They were absolutely overcome by their fear, and they were silent. They told no one. Something about encountering God, his presence, his work, his activity and movement in our lives can often cause us to be fearful, overwhelmed, and silent. And it's not the kind of fear where, like, you're afraid for your life. Oh, no, I'm going to die. Oh, no, like encountering a soldier with a sword, I'm going to die today. It's not the kind of fear you might feel if you encountered someone who was powerful and wealthy and could use their wealth and power to destroy you. Not the kind of the fear of poverty or the fear of economic downturn. It is a fear of judgment. It is a fear of being judged. You know that over and over again, you may not realize this, but in the life and the work of Jesus, one of the primary responses to Jesus was fear. And they weren't afraid of him because they thought he was going to hurt them. They were afraid of him because of the awesomeness of his holiness and righteous character. They could just discern and know somehow that they are in the presence of someone who is not like me. Someone who is pure and righteous and holy and sinless, and though they maybe couldn't have come up with those particular words, just being in his presence was how they felt. In fact, there was a time when Jesus was in the presence of someone actually helping them fish that day, professional fishermen, and Jesus' presence meant there was an incredible record-setting catch that day of fish. When one of those men realized the power and the presence of this stranger, I hardly know the man, Jesus, his response is not to say, yay, sign me up. His response is to fall and say, go away from me. Often when God is at work in our lives, our response is not to embrace, not to jump and shout, but to say, go away from me. I don't want anything to do with it. I don't want to be a part of this. We're fearful. And one of the reasons we're fearful is because these Jewish men, and you don't have to be Jewish to feel this way or sense this, these men somewhere had read that you cannot see God and live. And they're sensing and fearful that, you know, in God's presence, and I don't know who this Jesus is, but it feels like I'm in God's presence. What's coming next? I know what's coming next. I'm going to be judged. I'm going to be judged. And if I'm going to be judged, I know for sure I'm coming up short. I will be found guilty. There's no way. It's like standing on a day where the sun is just coming through your window so strongly, and the light is so pure as it comes through your window. And you've seen this where you can see the dust particles floating through the stream of light, right? Just standing in pure light, you can see the impurities of the air that just now you are breathing. You couldn't see that before, but in the light, you can see the impurity. In the light of Jesus, in the light of God, you see the impurities and you think, I'm in big, big trouble. But can I tell you that also standing in the light of the presence of the one who is pure light was not only an exposure of the impurities of our lives, but it was an exposure to the compassion of God as well. For the same one who is pure light and purely holy and sinless is the same one who asks the blind man, what can I do for you? It's the same one who would touch the leprous man, who had probably not been touched his entire adult life, because who touches a leprous man? God does. The same one who would allow himself to be touched by a woman whose illness has tormented her for many, many, many years. They were fearful of being judged that day, and they ran. They ran for their day. They ran in terror. They ran in fear, and they were silent. They're fearful of inadequacy. To be in the presence of God, we sense that God somehow is like doing something in our lives. Maybe we have a dream at night. We've had more than one dream. We've had a series of events that we keep calling coincidences, but we're starting to think, I don't think this is just a coincidence. And I'm not a really religious person or anything, but I think maybe this is God showing up in my life. You know, I don't have the language or the vocabulary for it, but I sense there's God all around me, and I'm responding and I'm feeling it. And quite frankly, I feel very, very inadequate. Inadequate. I've been doing baptism classes for literally decades, right? And almost every baptism class, there's always someone who will say something like this. They'll say, you know, I'm not really sure that I should get baptized because, well, I'm not really perfect, you know. I got some things I'm working on. I'm trying to clean up my life, and you know, some bad habits I want to get over. And so I don't know if I'm going to sign up for the baptism, you know, next week or in 2 weeks. I'm going to keep working on getting better. And I'm going to keep working on improving my life and kind of getting it all together. And when I get it all together and I'm really living in a way that I know that God would think was, and this is basically what they're saying, that I know that God would think was adequate, then I'll be ready to meet him and enter into the waters of baptism. And then sometimes they'll say, well, what if I get baptized and after that, I just really mess up? What happens to me then? Maybe I shouldn't get baptized. Maybe I shouldn't really do this because I could possibly make a mess of my life a year from now. I better not do this. And there's this overwhelming sense of inadequacy. Inadequacy. They're fearful that they'll be inadequate in his presence. Peter and James and John were invited up to a mountain retreat with Jesus, and while they were there, they saw Jesus like they had never seen him before. You can read about it in Mark chapter 9. They see the fullness of the glory of God in their friend Jesus, and it so shakes them, they become fearful. There's the word again. Peter becomes so fearful that what he offers is an inadequate response. He says, maybe we need to build three like different spaces so that all these guys who've come today, we can all, three, he called them tabernacles, three spaces that we can, three small buildings. And it was a sincere but inadequate response. What we're afraid of is we don't know how to respond. And so those three women, they ran terrorized. I don't know how to respond to what's happening to me. I don't know how to respond to the work of, I think, God in my life right now. I don't know what to do, so I'm going to stay quiet. Thirdly, there's the fear of rejection. You know, in the last 24 hours before Jesus died, everyone that was close to him abandoned him. And now, 3 days later, after his death, still, I'm sure, reeling from the guilt of knowing that the man that we loved and believed in and counted on us on his very last day, that he died so brutally, we all left him. Now discovering that he's alive, maybe he doesn't want anything to do with us. I mean, if he's back, if he's alive, maybe he's like, you know, you guys rejected me. You abandoned me. Maybe I just reject you. I mean, you weren't there for me. And there's a fear of rejection. They're afraid of the possibility, at least in their minds, that if this is true, whatever they had in Jesus is lost to them. Fourthly and lastly, the fear of the impossible was now possible. The fear that what was impossible is now impossible. You know, this word for fear that these three women had is actually appears several places in the Bible. You mentioned Peter's story, but it also appears in a story in the very first book of the Bible. And it's a story of a couple named Abraham and Sarah. And Abraham and Sarah are in their 90s. Now, I know you probably think that strange things happen in Bible days, and it's kind of like there's a whole different set of rules for the people in the Bible. But can I tell you that in the Bible, if you are in your 90s, you're not going to have babies. I mean, it might be Bible days, but, you know, 90s are 90s. People don't get pregnant in their 90s. But yet God had made this promise to Abraham and Sarah that they would one day have the baby, a child of their own. Yes, they're in their 90s. And so here again, Abraham is encountering another divine angelic messenger, someone from God, supernaturally, telling Abraham, you are going to have a child. I'm going to keep that promise. And Sarah, who is not directly involved in the conversation, but slightly removed near her tent, hears the man say, you and Sarah are going to have a baby. And it says that she laughs within herself. Not out loud, but within herself, kind of chuckles like you might when you hear something absolutely ridiculous. And you go, sure. You know, you're laughing within yourself. And then the messenger that has come from God, the supernatural messenger, says, why is Sarah laughing? Oh, man, she didn't laugh out loud, but he heard it. And then she lied. She said, I'm not laughing. And the Bible says right there, it uses the same phrase for fear. She was afraid. She was afraid that what she knew to be and believed to be impossible was now possible. You know, pregnancy can be one of those things that once we have decided that it is absolutely impossible, to hear now that is possible can cause its own unique kind of fear. Oh, no, I didn't think this was possible. I didn't think this could happen. Someone who has said, I'll never be married, I just don't think it's possible. I've kind of written that off. It's impossible. It's just not going to happen. Now sees themselves in a loving, committed relationship, moving toward marriage. And while there's a lot of joy and there's a little bit of fear, like, wow, this is happening. I never thought that this could happen, where the impossible becomes possible. The resurrection is a place where we stop. It's a place that we stop in the end of one chapter before we begin a new chapter. The resurrection is a day where we pause, but we don't stay here. It is a day, the resurrection is a day where we prepare for a new beginning. A new beginning where faith will overcome all of these fears. Because what's going to happen for these three women, Mary of Magdala and Mary, the mother of James and Salome, as well as all the other disciples and everybody who knew Jesus, was they're going to overcome their fears by faith. These three women will overcome their fears, overcome their terror and their silence. They will give the message that the messenger gave to them. They will speak to the other disciples. They will believe in Jesus. They will follow him. And the book of Acts and the rest of the Bible is the telling of the new beginning that is birthed on this day. Terror and fear are overcome by faith, trusting and believing in God. And can I tell you that if you and I are going to wait until we're not afraid before we start trusting God, we're going to be waiting a long, long time. Faith is birthed and initiated and begins even while we're still afraid. Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief. Even while we're yet afraid, even while we are fearful of rejection and fearful that we won't be received and fearful of the impossible, yet faith is birthed and arises even in the days that we are fearful. And I encourage you today, let faith arise. I know you're afraid. I know you're fearful. You sense a stirring that maybe God is drawing you to Christianity, and you are going to come out of a religion that will oppose what you know is happening in your life and is fearful to you. Maybe you know that God is at work in your life and he's being saying things to you in dreams and visions where he is affirming to you that Jesus Christ truly is the Son of God, and he is what we all know him to be, the person that the Christians have saying that this is who he is. You are coming to faith, but it's causing you to be fearful. It's causing you to be terrorized, and you've remained silent. Let faith arise in your heart to believe the impossible, and to tell others, and to follow him. In Jesus, hope is fulfilled, promises are kept. For the last year, Jesus has been telling his friends, listen, guys, I'm going to Jerusalem. I am the suffering servant. Okay, that's not just a phrase. I am going to suffer. I will suffer at the hand of our Jewish leaders, our national leaders. I will suffer at the hand of the Roman government. I will be arrested. I will be crucified. And on the third day, I will be raised from the grave. But guys, he's been telling them this for a year to get them ready and to prepare them for what was yet to come, promising that though you will see me suffer, you will yet see me raised to new life. Promises are fulfilled. Hope is kept in Jesus. He said it to them in Matthew 14, after I am raised from the dead, I'll meet you in Galilee here on this resurrection day. The angel repeats the promise of Jesus. He has been raised from the dead. He is risen, and he will meet you in Galilee. They did meet him in Galilee. A new chapter did begin, just as it must for all of us. You can't stay here. You can't stay here. No, I don't mean like we have to leave by 6 o'clock because there's a 7 p.m. service tonight. I mean the resurrection isn't a place, the empty tomb isn't a place where you stay. It's a place where new beginnings happen. You can't stay here on this day. You've got to go on. You've got to go on to Galilee. You've got to go on to whatever is next for you and for me. We've got to move on from this place. It's a great place. It's an empty tomb. It's the confirmation and affirmation that everything Jesus did and said is true. And there's power and promise and fulfillment of that promise. We're not going alone, and we're not going with fear, and we're certainly going with him, but we can't stay in the front and staring into an empty tomb. We've got to move on. Maybe it's Galilee. Maybe it's home. Maybe it's into a new semester. Maybe it's into a new job. Maybe it's into faith in Jesus Christ, but you can't stay here. You've got to move on. You've got to move. When I was working with students many years ago, Becky and I, we'd have students, we'd be at where we were meeting, you know, and students, high school students, they love to come early and stay late. Stay and stay and stay. So they get later and later and later. Everybody's just hanging on. And finally, we would have to say to them, guys, you got to leave. You got to leave. Seriously, we're going to turn the lights out and everybody has to leave. You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. You can't stay here. You're going to move, and God is going to lead you because there's an empty tomb.